We ask no more questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
And welcome to another episode of Dads on the Air. It's the 28th of September 2010, and on today's show we will be playing a presentation from the Newcastle Men's Health Conference in 2009. Okay, and in this presentation is Paul Pritchard and Richard Fletcher. Richard Fletcher is from the Uni of Newcastle, and the presentation is titled Fathers at Heart, and it talks about the importance of fathers in and being central to early childhood in Australia. So stay tuned for that. I'm Phil York from Dads in Distress, and in the studio with me we have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com. Good morning.
Good morning, Phil. Good morning, listeners. Yes, and I'd like to announce this morning it's actually my son's 11th birthday, so a bit of absolute relevance for dads. Happy birthday, Maxie boy. Your daddy loves you.
Happy birthday, mate. All right, let's get into the news, shall we?
Sure. Well, look, I've got a few little items here. In Saturday's Daily Telegraph was an article under the heading Singles Curling Up with Their Best Furry Friends at Night. Nick Christensen has written, they are a man's and a woman's best friend. Now, for an increasing number of single people, a dog or a cat is easing their loneliness by sharing their bed. About one in three singles said they let their dog or cat in their bed, a major shift from 10 years ago when just 8% would do so. And I've got to say, I'm one of those people in that category. I sleep with a cat. Certainly beats lying there by yourself night after night. So, yeah, that's what we're all doing. We're all sleeping with pets, living here in the sexual desert. Nobody can get laid anymore. Sex has become unfashionable. Bring on the sex party, I say. We need more. We need more people sleeping together. Hey, anybody who wants to sleep with me, contact me through the station. As long as you're female, that's about my only criterion. Age between 18 and 69, say.
Nice. Very
charming.
Nice.
Bit of free advertising. Yes.
Yes. Story here from the Sydney Morning Herald. Parenting orders in doubt after high court ruling. Thousands of family court orders could be invalid after a landmark High Court decision, and the federal government has revealed it is drafting urgent legislation to avoid mass confusion among parents. In the high-profile case of Rosa versus Rosa, a mother had been forced to remain in Mount Isa caravan park, depressed and relying on welfare payments after she moved there from Sydney for her husband's mining career, and they separated by memory about 6 months after they moved up there. The High Court found unanimously that the decision was wrong and ordered a fresh hearing in March. Now, the reason why they found it was wrong is because although the legislation says that a child has a right to equal or substantial and significant time with both parents, the law doesn't take into the reasonably practical part of that for the parents. So this means that a cloud now hangs over the status of thousands of parenting orders and consent orders granted by family courts, which have not addressed the question of reasonable practicability. The Attorney General, Robert McClellan, said the government is preparing priority legislation to clarify the validity of existing parenting orders. So watch this space.
Absolutely. Well, look, I've got another one here. This is from last Thursday's Telegraph. Childcare centres fail basic hygiene. Sue Dunleavy has written, one in five of the nation's childcare centres fail to change nappies hygienically, protect children from dangerous products, or ensure they get enough sleep, a damning new report shows. And 40% of the failing centres are in New South Wales. A national childcare Accreditation Council report released today revealed that 1,129 centres across the country were reprimanded in the first 6 months of this year for failing to meet basic standards, and 243 centres failed to gain accreditation at all. Centres that fail the standard have 6 months to clean up their act, and 886 centres have complied. Centres that do not are referred to the state licensing body, which can revoke their licensing approval, and this could lead to the centre losing access to childcare subsidies. So a bit of a crisis going on in childcare, really, you know, dirty centres.
Yeah,
well, at least they're not in New Delhi, that's all I can say.
Absolutely, mate.
And don't send them to the Commonwealth Games.
You know, the other thing with childcare centres is, you know, the lack of men that work in childcare centres. You know, so lots of these children go to childcare centres and they come home to single-parent houses with generally their mum. So they have no contact with men within their normal daily structure. And further to that, I was watching a program about a week or so ago, and they had two male childcare workers there, and they were saying that it's against the policy for male childcare workers to actually change nappies.
Oh, God, well, because we're all pedophiles and we can't be trusted to be within, you know, 20 feet of a child's genitals.
Yeah, I know. It's
stupid.
Bizarre.
It's all gone too far, and all of this breakdown of the family, I mean, and, you know, all the women out working, you know, and the children suffer. The children suffer, and here they are. And, of course, you know, everybody needs to make a buck. Everybody's basically got you've got to get paid more for your service than it's actually worth, or you don't make a profit. And here we are in the situation where children, once again, are suffering. The innocents who cannot protest, who cannot, you know, look after their own interests, they are the ones who suffer at the bottom of the heap.
Indeed they do, and they're the most important. They're our future.
Well, they are. Yeah, they are. Absolutely. No, it's shocking. Well, look, one more. This should put a bit of a smirk on a few faces. Saturday, September 25, Daily Telegraph. Chloe puts the X rated into the latest X Factor. Neil Sears in London has written, "The British show The X Factor has been accused of glamorising prostitution to impressionable young girls by refusing to axe a contestant for using her newfound fame to increase what she charges for sex." Chloe Heald, who calls herself Chloe Mafia, was exposed as a prostitute as she appeared before 12 million viewers last Saturday night. Despite audience boos, Judge Simon Cowell put her through to the next round. It then emerged that she was still offering sex for money while staying in a Wembley hotel in North London for the show's boot camp stage. Touting on one website, she wrote, "I want to meet guys and girls for nothing but dirty fun. I've just been on the X Factor, and yes, the next round, just keeping it real. I can sing, dance, yes, like a slut too, and I've loads of naughty outfits." So there you go. So obviously being a prostitute has lost a lot of its stigma in the 21st century, and it's all just a good laugh, apparently, and showing this off to impressionable young girls is not seen as in any way endangering their development or moral health.
Exactly right, mate. They put that out there in front of the community. It's a very popular show. Lots of young girls watch this show. They would like to be on this show, and they find themselves...
They look up to the people who appear on it as role models. They imitate them. They all buy the same nail polish. They'd like to wear the same clothes. You know, they take on the phraseology. And, you know, now they're going to... Well, hopefully not too many little girls will want to don the profession with it as well. I mean... Yeah, it's all getting sicker and sicker by the minute.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of stories here in regards to the Ken Thompson saga.
Oh, yeah, that's had a bit of a happy ending, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, mate. It has. Well, you know, there's still got a long way to go, but at least we're all on the same page now, and we all know where Andrew is, and
yep,
he is safe and well.
Fantastic.
The Australian reports on the 21st of September, Peter Wilson, headlines, "Andrew's dad wants police to act against charities who helped wife. Ken Thompson has called for investigations following the disclosure his wife received help from charities after fleeing with their son." The Australian revealed yesterday that Melinda Stratton, Andrew's mum, received shelter from two Christian charities in Amsterdam and stayed for a lengthy period with friends in Austria after fleeing during family court hearings in April 2008. Ms. Stratton appears to have also received support from people in Australia and was in contact with a barrister in England who has not been named for legal reasons, but this barrister also had links to Ms. Stratton's supporters in Australia. Mr. Thompson says that these people have been aiding and abetting a serious crime, the denial of human rights to Andrew and himself. There is no doubt that Melinda is highly believable, and just out of laziness they seem to have accepted her delusion that I am somehow a threat to Andrew. So we'll be interested to see what happens with that. And as I said, you know, at the end of the day, though, Andrew's safe and well.
And he now has contact with his father, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, that's right. And more to the point, and this is the next story that I'd like to read, is from The Australian, from the 26th of September. Runaway mum and son reunited in jail. So he's got to see his mum again, which is great. 6-year-old Andrew Thompson has visited his mother, Melinda Stratton, in a Dutch prison. It was their first time together since she was arrested for fleeing from Australia with their child 2.5 years ago. The emotional meeting came a week after Andrew had his first reunion with his father, Ken Thompson. Ms. Stratton was detained on September 8 when she went to collect Andrew from his school, but was met by police who was tipped off by another parent at the school. So it's
tragic for the child, you know, just tragic for the child, seeing his, you know, his mother being carted off by the police. I mean, the whole thing's just tragic. Tragic, tragic.
It is, it is. The Australian revealed this week that the mother and son had been living under a false name, Mandy and Timothy Welsh, and were supported for more than 6 months in the Dutch capital by two Christian groups, as we said before. So, you know, it is tragic. There is no nice side to any of this story.
Well, the fact that Ken's managed to find Andrew, that's...
Well, yeah, I guess so.
That's a huge advance in the situation. Now he has contact with his son, which has got to be better for his son and certainly better for his state of mind.
Yeah, yeah. You know. So the meeting on Tuesday between Andrew and his mum was believed to have begun tensely. Andrew was confused by the fact that his mother was in prison and angry with her over their separation. But the session ended up with a long hug, and government psychologists were pleased that Ms. Stratton had not tried to discourage her son from bonding with his father, who had his second supervised visit with the boy on the following day. You know, there's been other stories, and I'll just condense it, but there was a story about when they went into the flat where Andrew and Melinda were living. There were drawings and paintings and stuff, as you have, on the walls, and lots of them were signed with the false name, but there was one or two that actually had Andrew Thompson, where he'd written his own real name on it.
Yeah.
You know, there was also reports about... friends or people that knew Melinda and Andrew in Amsterdam, and she would say to Andrew, you know, you're a Welsh, your name's Welsh, blah, 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 and he'd turn around and say, no, mummy, I'm a Thompson. So, you know.
Yeah, he knew who he was.
He did. So.
And his father was out there desperately cycling around Europe looking for him. What a hero, you know, and he came through with the goods. Personally, I thought this was just going to be another even more sad subtext to a tragic story, but Ken's found Andrew, which, you know,
yep,
is a wonderful thing.
That proverbial needle in a haystack.
Yeah, you know, and you sort of, you like to think that if you put in the effort that you'll get a result, but there's really no sort of cause-effect between cycling around Europe and, you know, actually finding Andrew. I couldn't see, you know, how that was going to result in it. I mean, sure, Ken had to go out there and he had to do something, and,
yep,
you know, something physical, and get there and work hard, and you're doing it for your boy, and you're doing it for your boy, and you can kind of understand his point of view, but I couldn't see the connect of how that was going to get him to Andrew. But it seems that somehow it's worked, a miracle, really. And you know, we wish Ken all the best here at Dad's on the Air. He's been on the program a couple of times, and we were following him and his journeys. And yeah, we just wish him well, and him and Andrew well, and hopefully they'll be able to establish some sort of semi-normal relationship, and much for so Andrew can grow up a normal, healthy young man.
Yep, absolutely. All right, we'll go to a break, and we'll be back with the presentation.
I'm standing hiding in the shadow, hating the world, hating them. I keep a wall around me, block out the herd. It's a nerve-wracked place to be, kills real quick. You gotta scrape the concrete off of your dick. But we're gonna live so happily in a faraway place, just you and me. If I don't crap out, the sun will shine and give us a hug. The world will sing like a happy bug. If I don't crap out, no, and I won't crap out. I know they're lying. If you want to stir up real mud, big guy, you had better pay with real blood. But the birds will sing a sweet melody in a couple of green indifferent trees. If I don't crap out, I'll find you out. Gonna write your name on a violet star. If I don't crap out, we'll have a window and we'll have a door and a reason to be living for. If I don't crap out, and the material singers will fade into dust like forgotten merchants of disgust. If I don't crap out,
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
Dad's in Distress. 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you, Richard. I also would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, those past and present. There's been a number of things for any man that happens in their lives growing up, being a child of another man, or on your journey as a young parent yourself. For the majority of us, we would have moments of realisation and moments of greatness. And there's a couple of very defining moments for me as a younger man. One was when I was 25 years of age and I was newly married and quite intrigued about this woman I'd married, who actually originated from northern Italy. So we saved our pennies and went over to a little rural village in northern Italy, about an hour and a half north of Venice, called Rachedo. And I couldn't speak a word of Italian, they couldn't speak a word of English, so I just had to make do with making myself busy and immersing myself in the day-to-day life, and nor was my wife interested in interpreting for me every moment of the day. About 3 days into my first visit there, not yet being a father of a child myself, I asked one of Leanne's cousins, or she asked him, if I could go out into the cornfields with him for the day on his tractor.
Oh, si, no problem.
So there I am out in the cornfields bouncing about on the back of his tractor, and he turned it off and listened to the bells in the village of Rashado ringing, and they rang for about 2 minutes or so. And this young Italian man, who was about the same age as myself, 25, he also was not yet a father of a child. When the bells stopped ringing, he swung round in the seat of his tractor and he cradled his arms and he said, "Bambina." I wasn't too sure what he was carrying on about. When we got back to the house, I asked Leanne to ask Max, what was this about? What was happening? And he said, "Oh, well, the village bells rang. Didn't Paul hear them?" And I said, "Yes, I did, but why would you, you know, what was special about it?" He said, "Oh, they rang to remind me, to let me know, first of all, that there was a baby girl born to the village in the last couple of hours." Now, in my Australian stupidity, I said, "Well, why would you want to know that, Max? Are you the father of this child?" And he looked at me like I was from another planet. And he said to Leanne, "Tell Paul, they rang to remind me and every man and woman in this village that we had a renewed parenting responsibility." So that in a few days' time, as I'm walking to the cantina to have a beer on Friday night with my brothers and my cousins, and I see that couple, or the mother and the baby in the street, I have a duty to stop them and to compliment them on the birth of their baby and to ask them, "Is there anything I can do to support you?" Now, a couple of years later, we had our first child and there were no bells ringing in Hobart. And our neighbours on either side of the house we were renting didn't know our names. But it was interesting, when we pulled into the driveway with a newborn baby in the back, neighbours from both sides were down at our car prodding and poking the baby and talking to us. So in fact the baby was building social capital for us as a young family. But I would suggest that we're a long way from the experience of Rashedo, where people who even aren't related to that family recognise a renewed parenting responsibility. This was this slide. Last night I had a conversation with Richard, and at that point we understood that perhaps we were going to have slightly less time than we thought we had. So I thought, well, that's all right. I cut my slides in half. But then I thought, no, that doesn't look too good. So I'll just cut down on what I'm going to talk about. But fortunately, I have got the time I need. I'm going to talk about the early childhood industry, and as someone who's worked predominantly for many years in the early childhood industry, a big issue for us has been, how do we engage men? Now, this is an industry that predominantly has female workers, and the intent there, the intention is there to do the right thing. The intention is there to engage effectively with mothers and fathers. But my experience is they have a long, long way to go. We hear often about groups of parents, such as Indigenous parents, teenage parents, and dads, as being hard to reach. Margie Whaley in the United Kingdom, who started Peng Green, would suggest that, in fact, we should turn that on our heads and say, it's our services that are hard to access, and that's why men aren't walking in the door. The well-meaning, nervous new dad fronts up to the early childhood service and encounters a Rottweiler receptionist who makes an assessment as to whether he's to be lucky enough to finally get to be educated and judged by the clipboard-wielding expert with square glasses and a pointy nose. After surviving this experience, does he come back? Well, the answer is obvious. Not likely. And we sit there wondering, what is wrong with him? why hasn't he come back to my service? Because I did the best job possible, or what I thought was best. The answer can be found in, it's not the dad that needs to change. It's the service and the worker and the entire sector. A big one, and if you download, in fact, the Father Inclusive Practice Guide that was referred to before can be freely downloaded from the FACSIA website. If you download that and have a look at it, it's really a dummy's guide to working towards being a more engaging service for men. A big one is to look seriously at the knowledge, skills, values and attitudes of the worker. Yes, dealing with looking at colour schemes and magazines on tables and stuff like that, that's useful, but it will not have the same impact as putting a significant amount of energy into assisting your workforce and your colleagues to actually have the knowledge, skills, values and attitudes in order to make them an attractive person to be with in relation to a man fronting up to them to get support. Here are some things that have said to me and have been said to me in the process of facilitating workshops around engaging dads around the country. Our service is called Maternal and Child Health, as a reminder to me that don't talk to me about dads, our business is women. Now, maternal and child health nurses, if you don't know, are the front line after midwives of engaging with parents. They're one of the earliest opportunities for us to surround families with support and love and care, and to help them ensure that the baby fronts up to school 4 or 5 years down the track happy, healthy, confident, competent and ready to be a valuable contributor to our society. My 13-year-old son did the transitions for these slides, so I don't know what's coming. How can we assure the mums that they will be safe? Now, a large part of my work at the moment with the Centre for Community Child Health is working with the Tasmanian Government as they roll out 30 child and family centres, early childhood centres, that are aiming to work from an integrated model. So bringing together kindergartens, childcare centres, community playgroups, and other maternal and child health nurses and others working in the early childhood arena to work in a truly integrated way. And when it's very interesting to see that quite often in the conversations with these cluster of services who've come together for the first or second time to talk about what is possible, we have put squarely on the table by one or two of them this issue of safety, as men as predators, as men as risks, as if we are asking them to do something so dramatically different that suddenly this is going to be an unsafe place for mothers and children to be, rather than assuming that if we're going to engage with a family, there's going to be a mother and there's going to be a father and there's going to be children. Sometimes the father's not going to be there as often, sometimes the mother's not going to be there as often, because quite frankly the definition of family and parent is changing quite dramatically in Australia. We've been doing it this way for 30 years and all the mums who attend are happy with it, so please don't tell me that it has to change. Now, there's a statement from someone who's really confronted with this notion of change, changing the way I do something in order to ensure there's a more helpful outcome for the child. Dads don't want to come here. They don't seem to feel comfortable. We tried engaging dads last year. It didn't work. So what's changed to make us talk about it again? I'm not sure how you answer a question like that, because obviously engaging dads is a project that you try. It's not something that you incorporate into your practice from the perspective of this person. So, if we are interested in this notion of change within the early childhood industry in order to make sure that that dads are engaged a whole lot more effectively, why do we engage dads in the first place? It's not because we actually want to like dads and be good to dads, of course we do, but the end point has to be because there's a child. Because there's a child. What is at the centre of what we do? There is a child. And in order to understand the context that child comes from, we actually have to go out of our way to make sure we understand all the influences on the growth and development of that growing child. And that includes, more often than not, a man. So if we're just seeing a woman come in the door and we only deal with the woman and the baby, well, then we're actually only getting a part of the picture. And then we wonder why we get it wrong. A useful question to workshop with services that are interested in this notion of change practice is, what can we safely assume about men from our knowledge of them and from the context of our service? Well, we can spend a whole day talking about this, but there's a lot been written and now clearly understood about the assumptions we make on what we see walking in the door. And those assumptions we make can sometimes be very unhelpful and can dictate in a very negative way how I end up behaving and the messages I send to that person who's walked in the door, just from what I see, let alone what I say in the next 10 or 15 minutes I may have the privilege of spending time with them. So do I know the story of the man who's just walked in the door? Do I know perhaps that even though he may look a little bit confronting or be behaving in quite a confronting way, that there may be quite a confronting story that he has to tell? And do I give him the privilege of actually being able to tell it? I had a great opportunity when I was employed by an organisation called Good Beginnings to work quite extensively with midwives and with a number of hospitals across Tasmania and Victoria in developing a little program we called Dads Connect, which was an antenatal sessions for expectant fathers, where you'd have a male facilitator, and I understand there's other people in this room who are doing this similar stuff, but a male facilitator who fronts up to the antenatal session that 80% of first-time parents go to around Australia, and the dads go with the male facilitator, the mums go with the female facilitator, and you give them an opportunity to talk about whatever it is they want to talk about in relation to parenting. Now, after doing that for 10 years, we were able to gather some quite useful information in Tasmania. Part of that information is, what are the highest priority things that guys want to talk about before the birth of their first child? Now, when I'm facilitating workshops with people in the early childhood industry and I ask that question, what do you think are the top three things that we found that men want to talk about before the birth of their first child? More often than not, the response is suggests that we see men as being very much focused on themselves. Like, oh, he wants to talk about how he's going to lose his social life, he wants to talk about how he's going to lose his sex life, he wants to talk about how he's going to lose this and lose that and lose everything else. And that draws a picture that, in fact, we believe men are focused on themselves rather than focused on their partner who's pregnant or their child who actually is inside their partner. The reality is, and this is just in the context of Tasmania, that over several thousand men coming to these sessions, the top thing they want to talk about is postnatal depression. Now, that suggests to me that they want to talk about their partner, that they have heard about this awful thing called postnatal depression, they're a little bit anxious about it, they don't know much about it, and they want to tease it apart. They also want to talk about supporting their partner. How can I position myself to be the best support possible for my partner during the birth and after the birth? And they also want to talk about balancing work and family. Those three things suggest to me that they're very much focused on their child and their partner rather than themselves. Just out of interest, the other things I want to talk about are changing things at home, playing with the baby, breastfeeding, being different from my own dad, dealing with difficult in-laws, pets and babies, and changes to our relationship, including our sex life. Gets into the top 10, but certainly not into the top 3.
The pain is intense for both father and child.
We try to adjust and happy memories are fine.
It's hard to cope with a life full of stress
that's leaving us empty, our emotions a mess.
Despite our separation, our love
will not die.
Though many a night, Dad, we remember and cry.
So let's look to the future with courage and hope. It will keep us together, help us to cope.
We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me and for you.
There will come a time before we're too old. Discover the lies that have kept us apart.
No more will they try stealing what's in our hearts.
And so we will conquer betrayal and pain.
The truth we will learn and our freedom will gain.
So keep asking questions of why is it so. And sooner or later, the truth we will know.
Hey, all you children, we don't see you now. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me and for you. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me and for you.
When I'm working with early childhood services in my new role, to encourage the service providers who are wanting to put in place some type of change in order to be more attractive or work more engagingly with men, to think about what do men tell us about themselves as fathers? Because if we actually hear the stories of how they see themselves as fathers, it gives us a great insight as to what we could perhaps be doing to change in order to be a more attractive space and more attractive in my behaviour. When I push him in the swing chair, he just laughs and laughs, which gets me laughing too. Sometimes when this is happening, he looks straight into my eyes, and it's like I'm a best friend rather than just his dad. There aren't too many feelings better than that. Now, the slides that Richard showed us about the early brain development and that notion of mutual gaze, there's some fantastic footage on a DVD that we were involved in making called Hello Dad, which is distributed by the Institute of Psychiatry in New South Wales, or Good Beginnings. And in that footage, you will actually see moments of the newborn baby being locked on in what they call mutual gaze to the father. It's about that distance. And so, actually, biologically, you can imagine a breastfeeding mother with a baby about that distance away, and the opportunity in the time of breastfeeding for the mother and the baby to lock on. It's not just, as Richard said, a nice thing to do. It actually stimulates a chemical reaction in the brain which draws the father and the baby to each other. So it's not just happening in the head of the baby. It's actually, have you ever heard a dad say, oh, when I first saw my child, there's this gush of, oh, I just can't explain it. It was, I love you so much. Well, that's the same reaction happening for him. And it's a naturally protective thing for the baby. So there's the baby working, drawing the father to himself or herself, and forming the beginning of what we know as attachment. And if there's an attachment and that bonding has occurred, well, that is a strong protective factor that contributing towards healthier outcomes for the child in the early years. I built so many of them. There's been days I've gone to bed, closed my eyes, and all I see is bloody building blocks towers crashing to the floor. This gives us an idea as to what perhaps the foyer of our services can look like to start off with if we're early childhood focused. My putter and her putter are permanent fixtures in the lounge room. Every night when I walk in, we spend ages just putting a ball into a shoebox at the other end of the lounge. I always let her win. Very altruistic of him to let her win. But it points to the fact that if you listen to men around their interactions with their babies or their young children, they'll more often or not describe those interactions as activity-based. And so why is it that we expect men to come in and receive services in the early childhood industry in a way that perhaps is not activity-based, and then they choose not to come back again? I made sheet and pillow cubbies with my dad, and it was always great fun. We would lie in there and talk about stuff and pretend it was like a secret hideout. We even had food in there. Now I'm a dad, and it's on again. Even more fun now than it was when I was a little tacker. Now, this guy has been in and out of prison for years, but he has clung on to a pleasant memory, even though he had a very violent childhood. He's clung on to a pleasant memory that helps him define what a good dad is, and he's trying to put that into his own parenting now. Okay, so I know I want to have more men walking in the door. I'm wanting to be more engaging of men, and our service certainly wants our children to be happier, healthier, more confident, and therefore we have a duty to engage their fathers. I actually need to do a whole lot of work about what I know about these guys, what characterises this group of people called men, and how can the information that I've gathered actually help me engage more effectively with this group. Well, by getting all this information together, it helps me to empathise with them, to view the world from their standpoint. And the corporate world has put billions of dollars over years into understanding men and women and children. And we see it played out day after day after day on our television screens and wherever we turn our heads. So this advertisement by Audi, which is a car manufacturer, doesn't say a whole lot about men, I don't think, but you can bet your bottom dollar they've put a lot of money into understanding who is the biggest target audience, who are the ones most likely to buy their vehicles, and that's what they've come up with. I'm not suggesting that the early childhood industry actually needs to be start putting breasts out as advertisements to be more attractive to men. The only thing I've changed here is the name of the service. But this is a flyer that I came across in my travels, trying to attract parents to a parenting session. Now, if you can't read that blue colour, it's a session for parents of babies and young children. Parents are invited to attend our next class on parenting and babies and young children. This practical class will teach you to cope with the demands of early parenting and help you to know how to respond when it all seems too hard. Where Canaryville Maternal Child Health Centre, Tuesday 2nd of April, 9:30 to 12. More info, contact your session educator, etc. Right at the bottom, dads are welcome too. Now, have you seen this type of thing before? Yeah, okay. In my mind, and I'm sure there's people in this room that might agree with me, dads are welcome too is a statement saying, look, we're actually funded by this guy from Faxia to attract dads, but the reality is we don't want you to turn up because we're not ready for you and we're a little bit confronted by you, but we're just satisfying our obligation to our funding body. I'm being cynical, but really what I'm saying is that there's very little thought been put into, if we really do want men to walk in the door here, what language are we using? How are we sending a message to men, realistically, that they are welcome to walk in the door? Richard would suggest, and has on numerous occasions that I've been at, that men read the word parent as meaning mums. So very simple changes in our language and our literature can start to suggest that perhaps we're trying to understand the target group a little better. Who are we really marketing our services to? Now here's a Ann Geddes photo. The message is Happy Father's Day. It's a wise father that knows his children. Now, I don't know a whole lot of men that find this image attractive. If I'm kidding myself that we are trying to be more engaging of men and therefore we're going to put posters like this on the wall, I would suggest that perhaps you're barking up the wrong tree. Just out of interest, I sent this to a number of female colleagues working in the industry and said, look, what message does this send to you? Their responses varied from lucky partner to I'm always partial to a bit of eye candy, to what's that man, naked man doing with someone else's babies? The message here is let's not trick ourselves into believing by putting images of men on a wall that are actually attractive to women that it's going to bring men in. It's not. So there seems to be a recurring theme in our industry of bare-chested men and naked babies, which can start to get a little bit worrying. I would suggest that perhaps we need to start thinking about sending visual messages that are a whole lot more generic and don't require us to have a six-pack and a rugged, sexy look. Or a great way of drawing men in, as was suggested already this morning, is to actually do it through their children. There is no greater marketing tool than to get men fronting up to things than to actually get the children on side. Those of you who are parents will know just how well your children are machined to manipulate you. If we use children's art focused on men and what dads mean to them, send a much more powerful message, I'd imagine, than a hunky-looking beast on the wall. So, have we considered the critical early moments of our relationship in working with men, and how those early moments will impact on later outcomes for the child? So if a man, and there's an increasing queue of men in Australia who are parenting babies and young children in isolation, and I would suggest that men as single parents who are parenting babies are far more isolated than their female counterparts. Because when marriages or relationships break down, more often than not, women take the social fabric of that relation, of that family relationship with them. And men are far more isolated. And when they do pluck up the courage to front up to the Rottweiler receptionist, and find that, oh gee, very early impressions aren't good, I don't want to be here, I'm going to be judged about my capacity to keep this child safe. Well, then they don't come back. And we wonder why children are fronting up to school with learning delays, speech delays and other impediments which are characteristic of lack of contact with early childhood family-based services. In initial contact with mothers and children, what effort do we make to understand the whole family structure and where possible meet the father? Very subtle change in the first few questions that I may engage a mother with, but I should be asking myself, or we should be training our staff to be intrigued when we see a mother and a baby about, I wonder what else exists or who else exists in this child's life. And importantly, encouraging our industry and workers within it to reflect on our practice. Can we say to families these things? I will focus on your strengths. I will believe. I believe that you can change if necessary. I will always be honest with you. I view myself as no more important than you. And I am genuinely interested in you. Very important to consider what it is that men say about the worker. And if I'd known I'd had the time, I would have bought some footage of men talking about what appeals to them about the workers that they work with or that they encounter in early childhood settings. And more often than not, they talk about the casualness There's one bit of footage that I've got where one of the dads who's going to a play group says, you know, it was three or four sessions in before I actually worked out that he was the keeper of this place, talking about the worker, because he was just playing alongside this guy with children. And it wasn't important to the worker to say, hi, well, I'm the expert who runs this place and I call the shots. It was a few weeks down the track before the worker said, hey, do you want to give us a bit of information because we need to keep records, etc., etc. How does an individual acquire the skills and qualities needed to be engaging for men, women, and any other group of parents that we want to attract? And what might need to happen to support this change? And the answer to that question is sometimes hard, and it requires compromise, and it can be quite complex. But we need to start, if we're serious about engaging men in the early childhood industry, we need to start asking ourselves these questions. So just to finish up, what do we want to achieve? We want a service system that recognises, firstly, that we have to get it right for the child in the first few months of the child's life, the first few years. We have to engage effectively with the whole family in being truly committed to healthy outcomes for that child. The system needs to value fathering. We need to be in tune with the parents that we want to engaging. We need to continuously be changing and responding to what we see and hear from the different groups of parents that are fronting up to our service, rather than trying to impose a one-size-fits-all approach to parents. We need workers who are confident in their interactions with men. And we need a system that enables men in their parenting and pushes them forward and works with them from a truly strength-based perspective, rather than viewing them with doubt, where there's a shadow or a cloud of doubt hanging over the motives of the man who walks into my service. And importantly, obviously, in order to change, we need to be consulting on an ongoing basis. So that's my little blurb in a nutshell, and we've got time for some questions if there are any.
My worst fears. My my words to tears.
To cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
This issue of engaging fathers and young and with young families into services is such a critical one, both in the past and into our future, that let's have this opportunity to work with some questions. So I ask both Paul and Richard to come back out here, that this practice has not just been evident within Indigenous communities and dads and families. It's also in culturally, linguistically diverse communities, families, and other communities across Australia. In fact, the more marginalised or tested life's experiences are, it is those communities where this practice is flourishing. And so it's a very important area of what we are doing. If we could use the roving microphones for the questions, because the keynote segments are being taped and they will be available on the Men and Family Relationships Network website. If you don't know, it's mfrn.net.au, just as a free download over the next month or so. So you will be able to revisit what has been said. So let's take an opportunity for questions for Paul or Richard. First question.
Hi, this is a question for Richard. I'm Nick Hall. I'm from the Aboriginal Health Service down Hobart. I noticed when you were talking about the bubble wrap generation, I think you called it, and you were attributing that the concern, overly concerned about safety, to be the primary thing about that phenomenon. Now, in my view, that's not the primary thing about the bubble wrap generation. I would tend to call it the strip mine generation, because I think the primary phenomenon there is corporate greed, and that's what all this safety business is about. It's about the domination of risk to corporate profits, and how that is intermingled with the insurance industry and all sorts of other things. And it's not actually driven by care or a concern for safety. Would you like to comment on that?
Okay, that's a good point. I think maybe what I would say in light of that would be that what prevents us, I think, from effectively putting up a family-based response to that. So if you think about your local park, like where I live here in Newcastle, they've taken away most of the equipment because it's supposedly unsafe. And as you say, it might be the intersection of large corporate interests and the insurance industry putting pressure on the local council to say, well, if you don't take it away, you'll be at risk. But what I notice is that the people who tend to speak up and say, we need stuff like that, are more often the mothers. And I think us fathers, here in my own area, for example, are pretty quiet about this. Even though on a personal level, in a family setting, we might be the ones who engage in rough tumble play, encourage risk taking in physical areas. So a lot of the dads I hang out with really push their kids, girls and boys, to have a sense of themselves as risk takers in a physical way. But I don't hear them speaking up. So I was thinking of the lack of voice of fathers as my point. And whether it's, as you say, the influence of the corporate sector pushing the pressure on us to have a safer, so-called safer and safer world, I'd say whichever force it is that we're facing, the father's voice is one thing that I think would help us.
Fantastic to hear you, Paul and Richard. I'm going to put it in a plug at 1:30 this afternoon. Here's the theory from Paul and Richard about why we've got to engage dads and maternal and child health services. I'm running a program at 1:30, and it shows you how to work in partnership with maternal and child health services and get dads in. I've got more dads that we can poke a stick at, and they're absolutely loving it. The question that I'd like Paul or Richard to perhaps comment on is, how important is it to partner with existing services, however ill-informed or ignorant about dad's engagement is it to progress these issues?
Well, look, the best practice would tell us from other countries like the United Kingdom that it's critically important that we as a service system start to work in a much more integrated and collaborative way. Now, the question you've posed is the notion of working with services that perhaps may not be sharing the same culture or understanding, or may be out of whack with our approach. What do we do there? Well, what that service is providing actually is of value to the target group, and that is in this instance the fathers. There's an onus on us to put a lot of effort and energy into working on a relationship in order for us to assist that family to have the best outcome possible. That's an onerous task, I know, for a lot of services, because funding is always an issue, and the notion of relationship development is not something that's funded. But essentially what I would suggest is that if we want to get it right for children, we actually need to be putting into our planning around the way we work and around the way we function as an organisation, that there are key people in our organisation whose at least a quarter of their role is this notion of relationship development across the sector. Because if we don't know each other well as services, if we're not able to work together because we're not aware of the different service cultures, we haven't negotiated in regards to different ways of working together, well then it's inevitable that the outcomes for the child and for the father are going to be substandard.
I've got a question for either of the speakers today. As far as I'm aware, not a lot of work has been put into actually attracting men into the early childhood sector as workers. I'm just wondering whether that's something you see would be a good thing, and whether you know of any what might be a good approach to take to actually try and attract more men in as workers into the sector.
Yes, it's fundamental, I think. People balk at that because it sounds like you're looking at sacking half the female workforce and employing males, which I don't think is the idea. Many females, as you know, who work in these service sectors work very well in collaboration with men. So it isn't a requirement that every female midwife has to be paired by a male midwife. You can see plenty of examples around Australia and other places where there's cooperation between services and there are men involved who aren't necessarily professionals but who are involved in running services alongside professionals. That's one aspect. The other aspect, though, is biting the bullet, and we haven't really seen that debate in Australia, I think. As far as I'm aware, there's only one example that I'm familiar with, and that's from the UK, and one of their very progressive local government areas took it as part of their policy that the people who work in childcare should reflect the community, like a basic idea. Not revolutionary in a sense, but if you think about applying it, of course, it is revolutionary. So if they had a particular... I didn't mean to say that about local government. If they had 20% of their population were from a particular cultural group, then they said, well, that should be 20% of our early childhood workforce. And this thinking is something that's not foreign in Australia, but it does stop when you get to this point where people say, well, come to think of it, 50% of the parents are men. Gosh, Australia, as you would know, is 3% of our workforce are men. And in England, under Blair, they took a national target of, I think, 3.5%. As that was really shooting for the top. They were going to have 3.5% of their workforce nationally as men. But the only case I'm familiar with is, I think it was Leeds, where they actually set their target at 50% male in order to reflect the community, not because they thought there was something wrong with the female workers, but just to reflect the community that they were serving.
Good morning. Mark McCosker here. I'm the chair of the Men's Committee in the Queensland Public Sector Union. You were talking before about the rough and tumble and the risk-taking. We had an earlier gentleman here who stood up and spoke more about the fact that it could be the insurance companies and the corporate sector which is causing all these problems. How do you go about changing the attitude further up? We're now in our schools, we have banned the rough and tumble. We're not allowed to do cartwheels. We're not allowed to stand on our heads, etc., etc. We're not allowed to play Red Rover and all this type of stuff. How do you, are you going to address that at this your level, and yet it's opposition at the higher level?
At my level, I'm not sure how I'm addressing it at my level, except to try and survive my 17-year-old who plays rough and tumble. But my point is that where are the blokes speaking up about this? Where are people saying? I mean, in the schools that we worked with, we had parents come to us, and so one parent from a local school came and said, my boys have been put on detention. And I said, oh, yeah, okay, is that a problem? Because boys get put on detention a lot. He said, yeah, well, it is a problem because he was put on detention for wrestling. And I said, oh, well, was it a fight? He said, no, they were just wrestling. He said, and when I asked the school to look at their policy, they showed me that they had wrestling just under carrying a knife as a risky behaviour. And I think we do need to change the culture. I don't think there's a recipe or a magic formula for changing this, because I see us being implicated in it, frankly, all the people sitting in this room. We're all experienced and have probably quite a great knowledge about a whole lot of things about fathers, but as a group we've been particularly silent about this area, I reckon. So I'm not having a go at the audience as opposed to myself, But I think we haven't been talking about this. We haven't been saying to the school, what a ridiculous idea that wrestling is like carrying a knife. This is something we need. The bit I think we can do from where I sit within the academe is to say, well, the evidence is there that this is good for development. I think that is also a responsibility that we have to tell people that.
Hi, I just wanted to go back one question to the workforce issue, and just wanted to throw up the issue of pay within early childhood, particularly within childcare, and career development, and consider the difference between those who are in positions of policy and management as opposed to those who are delivering services directly.
So you're making a statement that it's...
Both a statement, but also a question as to what difference you think that would make if there was equal pay, if there was career development, would men find that more attractive as a role, as a career option?
Right. What you're hinting at is, and you're absolutely right, that the early childhood industry, and in fact the whole human services industry, unless you're a medico, are remunerated very, very badly. And if we're to truly believe and put right at the pinnacle of what we're doing that we want children to be happy and healthy and confident, we need to invest properly in the first 3 to 5 years of the child's life. And that makes sure that we're actually buying in skilled, qualified, competent people. I'm not saying the current early childhood workforce isn't those things. What I'm saying is they're not properly remunerated. The problem we have is that the industry, the early childhood industry, is devoid of men, and it's no secret why. A, because of pay scales, B, because of opportunities for advancement, and C, because of the shadow of doubt looming over his motives when he applies to be a kindergarten teacher or a childcare worker. We still have evidence in Australia today of men being discriminated against because they choose early childhood as a profession, and parents actually saying, I don't want my child being cared for by that man. We have to ask ourselves why, and we have to ask ourselves why we allow this message to continue to be put out there in a world that's meant to be far more understanding of the needs of children. The reality is that one in three, or it's even more than one in three, of Australian children are going home from childcare centres and schools to a house other than where their father lives. And the schools and the childcare centres generally don't have men in them. So we're not really sure of the outcome, I don't think, of this experiment that we're performing on the last couple of generations of children, where children are growing up without men in their lives. We need to start taking this more seriously.
Yes, my comment, Director, that you, Richard. My name's Jeff Drake. I'm with Men and Families in Taree. I really enjoyed your presentation. Thank you. I was fortunate enough to send one of my children to Steiner School, and from kindergarten age, she was encouraged to climb trees, as well as the duty of care. They gave her the dignity of risk, which was vital, I thought, in her upbringing. She was taught how to bake bread and how to dance, play musical instruments, and work with instruments, etc., made from natural products. There was a totally different dynamic with her compared to our other two children who were raised in mainstream school. I just thought, with the brain development under the Rudolf Steiner system, they considered that from zero right from start, whereas in mainstream school I don't think they even thought about it so much. Thanks for your comments too.
Question to Paul. I work as an MFR worker up the Gold Coast, work a lot with separated dads, mostly separated dads with young kids. The issues that a lot of the guys face who want to be involved in the early years sector with their children is, one, the administration policies don't seem to recognise 50% share care. It's hard for them to get their name on the mail out lists and that type of thing. And two, the most important, a lot of the guys have DVOs and DVOs on the children. They're not allowed to go to the early years centre for celebrations, for birthdays, stuff like that. It's a huge, huge grief for them. And even the ones that don't have DVOs that want to be involved in the Christmas pageants and things like that, because of the argy-bargy and the separation, it's going to cause really bad conflict. I don't know if you've looked into that area, but the guys carry a deep, deep grief around wanting to be involved, but feeling sort of excluded because of those reasons.
Yes, it's a common story that you're telling. And the industry is, well, we're talking about being risk adverse before, and we buckle under the types of questions that you pose. But what we are now understanding is the benefit of tailoring our services within the early childhood industry to include targeted strategies to make sure that man can have access to his child with dignity alongside other men and women without them necessarily knowing that he has a DVO against him, etc. It's a huge issue. There are examples of it working very well in the early childhood industry with supervised access playgroups that have merged into community playgroups where that man actually is able to walk away with his dignity and integrity. But we still have a long way to go. Absolutely agree.
Let's put our hands together and just thank you for these two. Thank you for your vision, for your practice, and for being here today.
Change your mind, but the day
Dads in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're back, and what a great presentation that was from Paul Pritchard and Richard Fletcher at the Men and Family Relationship Seminar in Newcastle last year, talking about how to engage fathers, how to work with fathers, and truly understanding and pointing out the significance and importance of fathers in young children's lives. So fantastic stuff. So that's
something that should have been obvious, really, like all of
us. Well, yeah.
But it's not.
There's lots of things that are obvious to us, mate, but certainly not obvious to others. And I guess that's part of our role here is to get this information out so people can become educated and understand the whole process.
That's it. That's what we're here for. We are educators, Phil.
Absolutely. Now, talking about education, Dads in Distress have some information nights coming up in the Sydney area, and just wanted to go through some dates. So hopefully you've got a pen. If not, you can download this information by downloading our program on dadsontheair.net. But to kick off, in the Dads in Distress Support Services meetings in Sydney, we are currently running some information nights. We are running some family law and criminal law information nights. We are also running some domestic violence information nights. And one of my favourites, child support information nights. So to just give you an outlay of what it's all about, the legal stuff, we have family law solicitors and criminal solicitors coming in talking about family law orders, talking about process of court, talking about compliance and or contravention orders. The criminal lawyer is talking about apprehended violence orders and or the breaching of those orders and the importance of the information that you supply to the court within those matters.
When are these happening, Phil?
Okay, in Penrith we have we've already had the legal night in Penrith. In Penrith we have a domestic violence information evening on the 12th of October and a child support information evening on the 19th of October. In Chester Hill, we have a legal night, which is tomorrow night, the 29th of September, and a child support evening scheduled for the 27th of October. And right here in downtown Liverpool, we have a legal night scheduled for the 7th of October, a domestic violence night scheduled for the 21st of October, and child support agency on the 4th of November. Now, all those details you can either get, as I said, off our recording, or you can phone me on 0401 426 101. There's the music. We've got to go. Everyone take care, have a great week, and we'll be back next week.
And as Phil said, you can download the show from dadsontheair.net. It should be up in the next 24 hours. Have a good week.
With that.